From HanselMinutes.com, it's Hansel Minutes, a weekly discussion with web developer and technologist Scott Hanselman, hosted by Carl Franklin. This is Lawrence Ryan announcing show number 107, recorded live Monday, March 31st, 2008. Support for Hansel Minutes is provided by Telerik RAD Controls, the most comprehensive suite of components for Windows Forms and ASP.NET web applications. Online at www.telerik.com. Support is also provided by .NET Developers Journal, the world's leading .NET developer magazine. Online at www.sys-con.com. In this episode, Scott decodes the language of digital photography with photographer Aaron Hockley.
Hi, this is Scott Hanselman, and this is another episode of Hansel Minutes, and I'm sitting here at a bar camp meetup in Portland, Oregon, with my buddy Aaron Hockley, who is making that transition from amateur photographer to professional photographer. Thanks for sitting down with me.
Yeah, thanks for the opportunity.
So, I had lunch a couple weeks ago because I bought a Nikon D40, which was my first digital SLR. This is my first, camera that when I push the button, it actually takes the picture without a pause. And this was huge for me. And my ability at photography goes about as I can take a picture and I can upload it to Flickr.
You got to start somewhere. And that's, with the DSLR, that's one of the nice things is that you have the ability to go from a fully automatic mode where it does take the picture right away, but then you have the ability to tweak a lot of the settings as you learn more about, the different technical things that go together to make a good picture.
So what is the difference between a DSLR and just like, my little Canon point and shoot that I had?
A point-and-shoot camera, it gets its nickname, as a point-and-shoot because essentially you have limited options to control, the technical aspects of it. That has a fixed lens. There's a lens in the camera. You can't change the lenses. Whereas a DSLR, you have the ability to, attach a different lens, which is going to have any number of different technical specs as far as the focal length, whether it's a wide angle lens or a zoom lens, as well as the quality of the glass. You can get really cheap lenses. You can get lenses that cost, more than your car, as well as the ability to get a lens that has a different range for the f-stop, for the aperture, which controls some of the aspects in the picture.
Okay, so we're going to talk about f-stop and aperture in a second, but if I understand correctly, the fundamental thing that's interesting about a DSLR, the first thing that really strikes people is that when you look through the viewfinder, you are in fact looking through the lens.
Yeah, with a DSLR, you're looking at an actual, you're looking through the viewfinder, which goes down to a mirror, which reflects what's being seen out of the lens. And so, as opposed to with a point and shoot, where they will sometimes have an optical viewfinder, but more than often you're looking at, what the computer is interpreting as the image that's hitting the sensor. So, with the DSLR, it's more of a pure photography experience, I would say, where you're seeing exactly what the glass is seeing as opposed to what the camera is interpreting.
Yeah, I've had a number of times when I've moved the camera really close with a point and shoot and tried to take a picture of like a bee or something, looked through the viewfinder, taken the picture, and found out that I was, an inch off from where I thought I was because I wasn't really seeing reality.
Right, yeah. With a DSLR, generally exactly what you see is what you're going to get. There's usually, with most of the lower end and mid-grade DSLRs, usually what you're seeing through the viewfinder is 85 to 90% of what you're going to see in the actual picture. Usually there's just a little margin around that doesn't show up in the viewfinder, but will show up on your picture. Some of the higher end DSLRs, at least with the Canons, they actually have a full, you'll get 100% coverage of the field of view.
So I bought a Nikon D40. Would that be considered a very low level, entry level DSLR?
Yes, when it comes to DSLRs, there's really Canon and Nikon are the big players in the market. There's other companies, Sony, Olympus, Pentax, that have DSLRs. But really, when you're talking about the DSLR market, Canon and Nikon are the big players. And they each make, several different DSLRs, ranging from their entry-level ones like your D40. Canon's entry-level one is their Rebel XT or XTi. And those, price-wise, you're looking at around, $500 at that point, all the way up to their top-of-the-line professional-grade cameras, which, at that point you're talking maybe, 10 or $12,000 just for the camera body.
Wow. So, 10 or 12 grand for the body.
Right.
No lens.
That's just the body.
I felt the $400 I spent on my camera was an excessive amount of money. And I actually went and bought the D40 and not the D40X, the D40 having 7 megapixels while the D40X has 10.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't miss those extra 3 megapixels for the $400 extra it would have cost me. I'm feeling pretty good about my camera. And interestingly enough, the quality of photograph that I get out of my Nikon D40 DSLR with 7 megapixels is visibly and significantly better than the same, and I'm saying same in air quotes, same 7 megapixels I got out of my point and shoot.
Yes. And that's one of the things that the camera marketing folks, will love to tell you that more megapixels is better. And to a certain extent it is, but there's reality as well. I mean, the reality is you can make a perfectly good 8x10 print from, you know, a good 3 or 4 megapixel photo. And if you're talking about stuff to put up on the web, I mean, really a 3 megapixel camera is more than you need for a photo that's going to be viewed on, you know, even a 20 or, you know, 22 inch computer monitor. The DSLRs are going to take for lack of a better term, a better quality picture at in the same megapixel range, because they have better sensors. They have bigger sensors. So with a point and shoot, there's charts available online where you can compare these, but with a point and shoot, it's going to be a smaller sensor. It's not going to be as high quality as with a DSLR. So an entry level DSLR will have a higher quality image sensor than, you know, a mid grade or probably even some of the top of the line point and shoots. So.
And these are the CCD or CMOS sensors?
Mm-hmm, yes. And Canon and Nikon, they kind of do their own things with them. Depending on how they're doing it, some of them use a sensor that's an equivalent to, so that what you see through a focal length lens is the same as what you'd see on a 35 millimeter with that same focal length lens. Some of them have what's called a crop factor, so that
crop factor.
As in like cropping an image to make it smaller. And most of the Canons, and the Nikons, until you get into their real high end models, all have, anywhere from a 1.4 to a 1.6 crop factor. So what that means is if you put a 50 millimeter lens, which, you know, on a 35 millimeter camera will give you, you know, a certain focal length. If you put that same lens onto, you know, my Canon 40D, for example, is a 1.6 crop factor. So I put a 50 millimeter lens onto my camera and it gives me the equivalent of what you would see at it'd be about 85 millimeters roughly on a 35 millimeter camera. And that's just based on how much of what the lens takes in ends up being projected onto that image sensor.
I'm looking at the top of your camera here and it says 18 to 55 millimeters. And that seems like different numbers than what I got with the stock lens. And that's indicating that your lens can do what that mine cannot.
The 18 to 55 is basically, that's giving the range. This is a zoom lens, so I can zoom it in or out to get wider or more of a zoom on my picture. 18 to 55 is a relatively, 18 is a relatively wide angle lens. So at that range, I'm getting up, more of a scene into the picture. At 55 millimeters, that's more of a normal focal range that you might use for a portrait, or just some general indoor photography. You can get lenses that are wider. Some of the widest lenses, that you can get, are going to be like in the 10 millimeter range that are going to actually be able to see more than you would see just standing and looking forward.
So a larger width of field,
right,
than
so,
a human eye would have.
Exactly.
So when you start getting into fisheye lenses and things like that?
You can get into the fisheyes. And then, on the opposite spectrum is you can get really, really, really long lenses. There's a lens manufacturer called Sigma that just came out with a zoom lens that ranges from 200 to 500 millimeters, which is, a really long lens, especially when you start talking about multiplying that times 1.6.
Wow.
And yeah, that's when it's
kind of interesting. The multiplication is when you bring in that crop factor.
That crop factor.
So by zooming in, you're cropping out stuff that you would have ordinarily seen.
Exactly. So if I put that 500 millimeter lens onto my 1.6 crop factor camera, I'm really looking at about, 800 millimeters there, which is a long ways away.
Okay. So we were talking about f-stop and aperture, and I understand the lens quality is important, glass quality is important, sensor quality is important, But one of the things that I've been struggling with is I want those kinds of shots where I'm taking a picture of my kid and he's really clear, but the background is blurry. So is that what we call focal length, where how much of the space is in focus?
That's actually called depth of field is
there
the most common term.
Depth of field. I got that wrong.
And so how aperture plays into that, aperture kind of affects two things.
An aperture being the size of the hole that lets the light in to the camera.
Right. Aperture and shutter speed are very closely related. So okay. In order to get a photo that, you know, looks good, is properly exposed, you know, and looks like real life, you have to have the right amount of light that gets into the camera. And there's two things that control how much light gets into the camera. One is the shutter speed, which is how long the shutter is open. Mm-hmm. The longer the shutter is open, the more light gets in.
Okay.
And then the other thing is the aperture, which aperture, there's a series of blades inside a lens. I think when we were talking earlier, you used the term sphincter, which is a good way to think of it, and that they they will expand or contract to either let in more light or less light. The aperture value is measured in what's called an f-stop, which is actually mathematically, I believe it's a logarithmic equation. So you'll see an f-stop number that might be, you know, this is an f2.8, or this is f4, this is f11.
Okay.
What that number means is it's basically inverse to the size.
A low f-stop, so like an f-stop of 2.8 would indicate that the aperture is quite large and a lot of light is coming in.
Right.
And so then a high f-stop of like f11 would indicate a fairly small aperture and a fairly small hole for the light to go through.
Right. And so how that will then affect your photos is that if you're taking a photo in a, you know, a relatively dark area, you know, like this conference room we're sitting in is relatively dark, it's indoors, we would want to use a lens that has the ability to go to a wide aperture, which is a big hole, which is going to be a low f-stop number. So you might be wanting to use a lens that's, you know, f2.8 or f2 or even f1.8 or 1.4.
Okay, so then changing the f-stop on my camera, on my new DSLR, this is assuming I'm choosing not to say auto. I want to have manual configuration abilities here. If I make a really low f-stop, meaning a very large aperture, that sounds like a lot of light's going to come in. If I kept the shutter open for too long, I'm probably going to get a big white picture of nothing but light.
Right. Yeah. If you end up overexposing the photo, you'll end up with just a big white screen. And so that indicates that you either need to use a faster shutter speed to let in less light via the shutter, or adjust your aperture to a smaller aperture value to let less light in through the hole.
Okay. So let me ask you this, and I'm thinking about this in terms of high school math. Is it possible that I could take, one shutter speed and one aperture size, and then find another aperture size and shutter speed and get the exact same picture, even though one had a big aperture and one had a small, but I adjusted them such that they canceled each other out, and I was taking essentially the same picture?
Yes, that's exactly what happens. One f-stop is defined as a doubling of the amount of light that will come in. So one f-stop, like moving from F2 to F2.8 is considered one complete f-stop. So at F2.8, it will let in half as much light as it does at F2.
Okay.
So if your shutter speed is twice as long.
So from what, 200 to 400?
Say from, one 200th of a second to one 400th of a second.
Okay.
You know, with that doubling of the shutter speed, in theory, you should get a photo that's exposed and would look exactly the same.
Interesting. Now, would it look exactly the same, or would I have changed the depth of field?
That's the variable. That's the other thing that aperture affects, is that the wider the aperture that you go to, so the smaller the f-stop number,
okay,
you're going to have a shallower or a narrower depth of field. And depth of field, basically, you're measuring, you know, if I'm sitting across from you at the table and I take a photo and I focus on the front of your nose, for example, at a wide aperture, a low f-stop, I'm going to have a shallower depth of field than I will at a narrower aperture and a larger f-stop. So if I take the photo at, for example, f1.8 and I focus on the tip of your nose, what I'm going to find is that by the time I'm looking at your ears, they're going to be blurry in the photo because it's a really shallow depth of field. On the other hand, if I took the photo at, say, f5.6, probably your ears are still going to be in good focus. So that's the other consideration when you're looking at, you know, which aperture do I want to choose, is if you want to produce an effect, like you mentioned, you wanted to get, you know, a picture of, you know, your kids where, you know, they're in focus and the background is blurry, you're going to want to, you know, do that so that, you know, you're going to want to use a relatively low f-stop for that.
Okay, I'm going to hold that thought because I'm going to ask you a question about that in just a moment. But briefly, we need to thank our sponsors and pay the bills. We'll be right back. Hi, it's Scott Hanselman here. Hope you're enjoying the show so far. I'm coming at you from another place in time. Sorry to interrupt the show, but I want to let you know that putting together a podcast like this every week isn't free. The folks that pay the bandwidth bill is Telerik. They make the show possible, and they also make some pretty cool products like Telerik Sitefinity. It's a development platform for constructing websites, community portals, and intranets built all on ASP.NET 2.0, so you're using the various well-known goodies like master pages and membership services, data model provider, things that you already know. It's pretty flexible. You've got a very robust core that you can customize. You can plug in anything that you want, from complex applications for a CRM or just a little widget that displays the weather. If you're not big into the code thing, that's cool too. You get a full set of features out of the box like workflow, multilingual sites, content versioning that can all be added without code. There's also a whole bunch of pluggable modules and components for news, blogs, forums, polls, lists. This is all stuff that you can do without code. And it's a pretty good looking product as well. You've got a nice Web 2.0 administrative interface that lets you, as well as your boss who's not technical, be really productive. So check out Sitefinity.com and we'll get you right back to the show. Thanks a lot. All right, so you're starting to get my head around this, and I'm feeling a little better about my potential for being a decent photographer. So talking back about taking a picture of my son such that he's in focus and the background is blurry, but he moves really fast, and it's tough to get him to sit still. If I want a shot of him crystal clear, but I also want the background to be blurry, I feel like maybe I've got two things that are at odds, because if I understand from what you're saying, if he's moving fast, I'm going to need a fast shutter speed so as to capture him in motion without blur. But by doing that, I may not get the blurry background that I'm looking for.
Right. And so that's where, this is where you start to get a little bit into what you're paying for when you buy better lenses, is that, the very high quality lenses that will go to a very wide aperture, like an f1.2, for example. An f1.2 will let you to let as much light in as possible, you know, through that wide aperture, meaning that you can use a shorter shutter speed, as opposed to, you know, like a consumer grade lens, like the one that came with your camera kit, or the one, you know, actually the one that I have on now, you know, the absolute widest aperture that this is going to go to is maybe an f3.5 or even an f4.5. So it just simply won't be possible to do that with this lens. So that's why, that's why they make a wide variety of lenses. And depending on how much money you have, you know, like an f1.2 lens, you know, at a portrait length may run you $2,000 for a lens.
What is that I'm paying for? Why make that so difficult to pay for Joe Public on the street to have?
The biggest factor is, to get that wider aperture, you've got, more glass and more finely precision engineered glass in that lens. It will be a very heavy lens. If you were to hold it in your hand, you know, an f1.2 lens versus an f5.6 lens, there's going to be huge weight difference. Uh-huh. And so it's the build quality. It's the precision of the engineering. It's the R&D that, you know, the lens manufacturer has done to be able to engineer something to do that.
Now, in my brief experience, I guess I'm a prosumer now, not just a consumer, but a prosumer, professional consumer. I'm kind of an amateur photographer here. The bodies all seem about the same size. I would think that the size of the aperture can only get so big. Otherwise, it's completely letting in as much light as is possible to enter the body. Are there high-end cameras you might, you know, watch the Olympics on that are going to have giant apertures that are custom?
Generally, the camera body itself, it's all coming into a sensor, and the sensors are relatively small. And that, you know, the sensor in your camera, you know, the sensor in my camera is probably, you know, comparable to like the size of a postage stamp.
Mm.
So ultimately, that's where the image is going to. So Yeah, like you watch like an NFL game or the Olympics or something, you will see guys on the sidelines with these giant lenses, which, you know, again, they're dealing with giant lenses with lots of glass that will go to really wide apertures. But eventually it's all, you know, as the image passes through that lens, it gets reflected down onto a very small area. So
I've seen those guys with tripods for the camera and then another tripod for the end of the giant lens.
Yeah. Yeah. That's because some of those lenses will weigh, you know, 10, 12, 15 pounds just for the lens because there's so much glass in it. It's just, you can't handhold it steady at that point.
Now, one of the features that I noticed in my new camera is that there's JPEG, of course, but there's also this RAW, or I think it was called NEF?
RAW, yeah. Pretty much any DSLR, and most of the higher-end point-and-shoots now have the ability to record an image in RAW format. And RAW format is a proprietary format that comes from the camera manufacturer. Nikon, their file extension is, you know, NEF. Canon's currently is CR2. Their original ones were CRW. What a RAW image is, the best way to think of a RAW image is that it's a digital negative. It's a exact representation of the data directly off of the camera sensor, which is really cool because it means in that RAW file, you have every bit of data that the camera captured. The downside, if there is one, is that it's a negative. It requires some processing. You can't just put a RAW file on the web and say, you know, browse to my webpage, I've embedded these RAW files in it, because, you know, it's not a computer readable image file through any of the standard means at that point. So a RAW file will require some processing to turn it into a JPEG or a TIFF or some other format that can be widely read.
Yeah, I went up on the web and found that there was a release a while back for Vista and also for XP to read RAW files and see thumbnails of them, but you have to go to the camera manufacturer and get that driver. And I went up and found a Nikon RAW file thing that would allow them to show up in Explorer, but it only worked on 32-bit Windows, which I thought was ironic because if I had such a big file, wouldn't I like a 64-bit operating system to edit it on?
Yeah, that's one of the things where, because it is a proprietary format, the camera manufacturers like to, they're not necessarily real open about releasing all the specs for their format. And so, the manufacturers that make RAW processing software, often they even have to reverse engineer these things. But yeah, Canon and Nikon and the manufacturers, they'll release, you know, essentially it's a codec, like you have an audio codec that reads an audio file. Mm-hmm. You have a RAW file codec that lets Windows interpret a RAW file. But yeah, as you've discovered, much like any other manufacturer specific hardware or software, you're kind of at the whim of that manufacturer to get that to support the platforms you want. I would expect that Nikon would be releasing something for 64-bit Vista because it's not that obscure of a thing anymore.
Yeah, I didn't think so. I did notice that RAW support was built into Google's Picasa application, which didn't require any codecs to be installed, which was kind of clever. They'd reverse engineered something.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And also, I guess Windows Live Gallery's got some support for that kind of stuff. But don't most people just use this thing? Is it Lightroom on Windows and then Aperture on the Mac?
There's when you get into the people that are doing it seriously, for RAW processing, there's a whole kind of industry of RAW processing software. Adobe has it's essentially a Photoshop plugin called Adobe Camera Raw, which integrates with Photoshop or Lightroom or any of their recent products and will do RAW processing. Apple has a product called Aperture that does RAW processing. There's other standalone kind of niche applications. There's one called Capture One. There's one called Bibble, I believe it is, that all they do is RAW process. And then Lightroom, which you mentioned, does RAW processing, but it also does some a little bit of digital asset management, which is kind of a whole nother software field of if you're out shooting, you know, I mean, I'm shooting Startup Palooza, which is an event here in Portland this weekend. I'm probably going to shoot, you know, hundreds or, you know, potentially over 1,000 images on Saturday. Mm-hmm. How do you manage that many images so that you can find what you're looking for? And so there's this whole other category of software.
Now, this is an interesting thing. I just thought of, are you going to delete photos on the camera or do you always wait to get home before you delete a photo?
Yes and no. I will occasionally delete photos in the field. You don't want to delete photos in the field based on what you see on a 2 or 3 inch LCD preview screen based on how it looks on that screen. You know, what you see on a 2 inch or 3 inch screen on your camera, as far as trying to gauge an exposure or gauge whether something is necessarily tack sharp, quite often will be very different than when you get that on your computer monitor and you're looking at it at full size. Where I will delete photos in the field, or what you can do in the field that is useful, is if you look at your camera, any of the DSLRs will allow you to show what it's called a histogram, which is essentially a graph. In a well-exposed photo, it will look like a bell curve, and it's showing you a graph of the tonal range of the photo with all the range of values from light to dark and how much light versus dark there is.
That's what that is. Mine always go off to one side.
So yeah, if you're looking at your histogram and you see that you're consistently, you know, off to one side, or some images are off to one side or the other, it means that you've probably overexposed or underexposed the photo a bit. Depending on how bad it is, you know, it might be perfectly fine, you know, and you have to take into account what you're shooting. I mean, you know, like shooting outdoors in the snow is notoriously difficult because you don't want to, you know, blow out the white. You don't want to overexpose all that white so that the camera loses that data. But on the other hand, you want to grab the detail of whatever's in the snow. So where I will delete images in the field might be that, you know, I've shot a photo and I want to take a look and see, okay, so I was shooting and, oh, wow, I overexposed this bright area on the ceiling, or, you know, I got the foreground exposed correctly, but maybe the background I'm shooting against some sort of a white sky or something. And so,
can't you fix some of that after the fact? I mean, like one of the things that Carl Franklin, my producer, said that when we first started podcasting was, he said, for God's sake, don't overdrive the mic. And that's like the white area on the photo. At that point, there's nothing I can do about that.
You have exactly the same thing with a digital image, in that, you know, your sensor can capture, you know, a range of values. And if you vastly overexpose to the point where you have an overly white area, or vastly underexposed to the area where you just have a huge area that's pitch black, you won't be able to fix that no matter how much post-processing you do. If you get really close to that, a lot of times you can recover some detail. And the Canon cameras, and I believe the Nikon cameras, have a function where you can tell the camera, like on my 40D and on my previous camera, which was a 300D, one of the digital Rebels, there was an option to say, when I'm looking at a photo in the preview, if I've blown out an area to completely overexpose it where it's just white, have that area flash on the view screen for me.
I got mine stuck in that mode. It takes all the white and flips back and forth, white to black, white to black.
So if you're seeing that, what that's telling you is that this area is so light that the camera can't interpret it, it's going to come out as absolute complete white.
There is no data there.
There is no data there at that point. So depending on your image, that's the kind of thing I'll look for in the field. And if I've completely screwed something up like that, you know, if I have the ability to reshoot something, I will. But generally, you know, disk space is cheap. Memory cards are cheap. I'm going to, you know, I'm not going to start massively deleting things out in the field, you know, because there's a lot of work you can do post-processing sometimes.
You know, it sounds, I mean, now that space is not a non-issue, when I bought the D40, I ended up buying 4 2-gig cards, because I remember actually being out we were in Africa in 2001. We were in Zimbabwe, and we had a Kodak. I want to say it was a 240 something. It was the big square Kodak first, you know, 1.2 megapixel camera.
Yeah, I had one of those. It was like a 240 or 220 or I think, right. I had a 220.
And
maybe.
It had a compact flash, and it was the funniest looking camera. And I went to Africa with a 16 meg card.
Yeah, I think it came with an 8 meg card, and yeah. I recall having like a 16. And I think at some point I bought a 32 meg card, right. And I thought that was the biggest deal ever. Yeah. Now on a 32 meg card, I could fit maybe 2 images out of my current camera.
Yeah, and if you're not shooting RAW.
Yeah, the RAW, that's the other downside to RAW, is that, you know, a RAW image, because it's a capture of all of the data, you know, a RAW image off of, you know, a 10 or 12 megapixel camera is probably going to be, you know, 10 to 15 megabytes, wow. You know, whereas a JPEG might be, you know, 2 to 3 megabytes.
So. Yeah, I remember having to delete photos because we were there for a month, and that was a problem.
And you know, at that point, if you wanted another, 16 meg card, that was going to cost you a few hundred dollars. Now,
exactly.
You know, I just picked up a 4 gig card for, like $30.
Yeah. So, today on Twitter, you and I both noticed that there's Photoshop Express now, a flash based online Photoshop. But, frankly, I was kind of disappointed. It was more of it looked like Picasa or Windows Live Photo Gallery or any one of the many different, photo management applications with a button for red eye and a button for fix. But it wasn't really Photoshop.
No, that's one of my, I think it's cool that companies are releasing things like this on the web, especially for free. But calling it Photoshop is really a misnomer because, you go in there and yeah, there's some good picture editing tools. You can adjust, the color spectrum. You can adjust sharpening. You can do things like that. It's a useful tool, but it's not really Photoshop. The UI doesn't look like Photoshop, and a lot of what Photoshop can do, it can't.
There's no layering.
It's a very basic tool. It's worth all of what it costs you to use it. it's a good free editor. And I mean, if you need to make a quick fix on a photo, there's nothing wrong with it, but it's not really comparable to Photoshop. If people are wanting to seriously do some, real post-processing on their images, you can do a little bit with the free stuff like that or with Picasa or, paint.net even is an open source, .net application. If you kind of want to get a little bit beyond what you can do with the free tools, I encourage people to look at Photoshop Elements, I think street price is around $80. It's a stripped down version of the full version of Photoshop, but it's really designed for processing digital photos. It has the functionality you need to apply filters and do layers and things like that. It doesn't have some of the advanced stuff Photoshop does for drawing or, CMYK print processing and things like that. But for editing digital photos, it's really, unless you want to go spend $600, $700 on the full version of Photoshop,
Now, you had mentioned to me just before we started recording that you'd noticed something a little maybe possibly disturbing in the end user license agreement for this little service here. Because I know that as moving into professional photography, you're starting to think about copyright.
Yeah, copyright and licensing is something that, people need to think about. Even if you're just sharing your images for fun on a site like Flickr or Picasa or something like that potentially you're putting things out on the internet. Do you want people to be able to use it? Flickr's great in that they let you easily apply a Creative Commons license if you want to, have someone use it for a non-commercial purpose. Someone tipped me off to go look at the terms of service on Photoshop Express, which is what they're calling their free version. And buried down, I think it's section 8 is the licensing section. And buried down in section 8 of the terms of service, it says, I'm paraphrasing here, but by uploading photos to their free hosting gallery section, which is kind of the other component to it, you can edit photos and they will also,
This is separate from edit. You can edit and bring them back down to your own machine and they never get posted on the internet.
Or you can upload them and edit them and save them there. And I think they give you 2 gigabytes of hosting space for free.
Okay.
By uploading anything to the public hosting section, you grant Adobe a royalty-free, unlimited license to use your images for essentially anything they want, which is a bit disturbing because, potentially, that could be them using it for marketing. The way I read it is it sounded like they could take your photos and go sell them, which...
Well, keeping in mind that we're both, you're a photographer, I just bought a camera, and neither of us are lawyers. But it does sound like something that people need to start reading these things.
Yeah, it's something that... like I said, I noticed it. I wrote a blog post about it today. It's one of those things that I think if it gets any publicity, Adobe is probably going to have to rework those terms a bit.
You don't think there's any chance that we were misinterpreting it?
The way I'm reading it, it sure sounds to me like, it's pretty clear. You're granting Adobe a license to use the photos. You still own the copyright on them, but...
If I upload to Flickr or Live, Photos or Picasa or Microsoft's got Live Photos, Is there an implicit license?
Not on Flickr. I'm a big Flickr fan. I use Flickr. On Flickr, the default license, if you don't change it, is that you retain all rights to the image.
Okay. They're just holding it for you.
They're just holding it for you. Flickr makes it easy to assign, you know, a Creative Commons license. So if you want to say, hey, people can use this as long as they give me credit and attribution, you know, Flickr makes it easy to do that. I haven't used the Microsoft Live Photos.
But SmugMug, that's pretty sweet. Have you seen SmugMug?
I've looked at SmugMug a little bit. I haven't, you know, I don't have a gallery there, but, so that's kind of nice. The licensing thing is just something that, you know, it's one of those things people should be aware of. Somebody, made a comment on Twitter today in response to this discussion saying that apparently the YouTube license also says that, that whatever you put on YouTube, you're granting YouTube and Google a license to do whatever they want with. So I haven't verified that.
TV shows are up there. I mean, movies are up there.
I don't know, but at least the Adobe license, I did read it myself. And to me, it sounds overly broad.
So that's going to keep you from using this tool?
That, you know, among other things, like the fact I don't need somewhere else to host my photos. But, you know, if I was looking for a photo host, I certainly wouldn't, you know, grant it to somebody who just says, just because you post your photos here, I can do whatever I want with them.
Well, it sounds like the moral of the story, because again, we're, you know, we're just two guys with a microphone, is that people who are going to use any kind of a hosting service need to read the fine print and think about, is this going to serve the purpose that I need? But, I really appreciate you taking the time to sit down and talk to me about this. I'm going to go and figure out how to use the aperture and shutter speed now to take pictures of my kid. I don't think I'm ever going to get to the point where I'm running a professional photography business, but I wish you all the best in your new venture.
Well, thank you. And the good thing is, with a digital camera, your film is free. So you can play around and experiment and try different values and see what happens. And, you know, all it's going to take is your time, but, you know, you don't have to try something out. And, you know, the other thing is it's instant. You don't have to wait 2 weeks for the photos to come back from the lab to see what happens. So
cool. Well, thank you, Aaron Hockley. And I have been Scott Hanselman, and this is another episode of Hansel Minutes. We'll see you again next week.